Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 19th of May 2023 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, this is episode 74 in this series where we look at white contributions to civilization, and for the last couple of dozen episodes we've been particularly closely looking at British history. We looked at the Welsh or the ancient Britons, we looked at the Romans, we looked at the Saxons, and now we're coming up to where the Normans enter the scene. And we started off this series with Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community, and then we were also joined by Truthvids from truthvids.net. And I believe Truthvids has had a bit of a revamp to his website. Truthvids, welcome to the show. How are you doing? And do you want to let listeners know what's been going on with your website?
Yeah, hello Sven. Thanks for having me. The Truthvids site has got a massive makeover. It's long overdue. I got told by someone who has a lot of web design experience that it was old and archaic and out of touch. And, it looked like 10, 20 years old. And that person proposed a redesign and sent me like a picture of what a modern website should look like. So I just went with it. I took the criticism and just said, all right, let's do it. And now it looks much better and much more modernized. So I'd recommend have a look. And I'm always open to feedback. Truthvids.net.
Yeah, it looks very good. Very, very impressive. Good to see. Patriarch, how are you doing? How's life treating you?
Hi, Sven. Yeah, I'm doing well, thanks. I also checked out Truthvids website. It's looks very good, well designed and user friendly.
Yeah, and if people want to check that out, that's truthvids.net. And also you can find Patriarch at the Patriotic Arts Community on Telegram. Well, let's get into the show. And again, we're using Sharon Turner for our notes from his work on the Anglo-Saxons. He says, "It is recorded with pleasure by the annalists that Edward took off the heavy tax called the Danegelt. Ingolf ascribes the remission to the extreme dearth which raged in 1051 and in which so many thousand people perished. Touched with compassion for their sufferings, the king abolished the tax. It is added that the royal mind, according to some rumours, was impressed the more deeply upon the subject, because one day, when the collected tax was deposited in the treasury, the king was brought to see the vast amount, and the mass so affected his imagination that he fancied he saw a little devil jumping exultingly about it. His mind was certainly weak enough to believe such a fancy, and many about him were interested to frame some device that should give it a foundation. He ordered the money to be restored to its former owners, and no more to be raised on such an assessment." And I will just pause there. I mean, I think Sharon Turner is being a little insulting to him here, saying that he was weak-minded. I think this was a very, very good thing that he did. I think this is why he is remembered with such honour by people. That's why he's called Edward the Confessor. I think he's almost the equivalent of a saint, and that must be because he got rid of the Danegelt. And I think he could have seen a little devil jumping around in it, and that could have been what encouraged him to stop this, because quite clearly he saw that this was wrong to be taking all this wealth from the people. And I guess this wealth was going to him. It wasn't actually going to the Danes anymore. And he could see that it was wrong of him to be doing this. And the people must have been so pleased and so grateful for this to happen. I think this is a wonderful thing, the end of the Danegelt. What do you make of this, Truthvids?
Yeah, it's funny because Edward's seen as this weak king, but he was the only one who actually got rid of this gelt, right? This heavy tax that put a huge burden on his people, right?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly courageous of him and brave of him. You think this has been going on for a long time, and the kings all went along with it, and he's got a conscience, and he says, no, we're not having any more of this. I think it's fantastic. What do you make of it, Patriarch?
I think he's doing good by the people. Obviously, he's really concerned about them, and there's been a lot of tensions and issues with this for a long time. So I think, obviously, he probably thinks enough is enough, and it's clearly being more divisive than unifying the people in general.
Yeah, I think seeing that devil jumping around in it, that's just a representation of how wicked a thing it was to be, you know, screwing the people down so hard that they were extracting this massive tax from them, that just looking at it, it just looked obscene, actually seeing the amount of wealth that it actually was. Well, the Welsh had often molested the English provinces in their vicinity. In 1049, 36 ships of Irish pirates entered the Severn, and with the help of Griffith, the King of South Wales, obtained considerable successes. In 1052, Griffith ravaged a great part of Herefordshire, defeating the provincials and obtaining great plunder. So the Welsh come back into this now, and Irish pirates, that's not something I've ever heard of the Irish doing before, so they team up together. The death of Godwin rather exalted than abased his family. If we remember Godwin from the last episode, his character was tainted. He was approaching the feebleness of age without having secured its reverence. He had no influence but from his power and greatness, which is only secured by terror or extorted by force, and is the creature of casualty which the first tempest may destroy. But Harold had all the brilliancy of youth and active courage. His character was full of promise because, being born to dignity, he had sullied himself by no arts to attain it. There was a general ardour in his actions which compelled admiration. When Edward raised him to his father's dignities, he gave new lustre to his family and obtained all the influence to which his father had aspired. So I'm guessing there that Harold, another Harold that comes in here, must have been the son of Godwin, who died in the last episode. Treefids, do you know anything about this?
Yeah, this is the Harold who would become king, right? So here they're saying, Sharon Turner's saying that Godwin had he'd done so many things, like he'd lured those princes in and killed them, and he was switching sides here and there. But Harold would be perceived as innocence and a breath of fresh air. And as we see, Harold started to rise up and eventually became king, right?
Right. So he's nothing like his father then. When Harold received the honours of Godwin, his own dignities in Essex and East Anglia were given to Algar, the son of the deserving and patriotic Leofric, who we remember gave lots of good advice to the king. But Algar's rise to power was no pleasing omen to the family of Godwin. Within less than 3 years afterwards, he was made a victim by being banished without a fault. But Algar was too injured to be inactive. He fled to Ireland, collected 18 piratical vessels, and interested Griffith, the King of Wales, in his favour. With this aid, he suddenly appeared in Hereford with great success, and though Harold went to oppose him, yet such was the state of Edward's court and councils that Algar, though rather by violent than legal measures, regained his patrimony and power. His allies went to Leicester and were remunerated by his father. And in 1058, he was exiled again and by the same means restored. The great were now dividing into new factions. So that's quite interesting. So Algar must have linked up with the Welsh and also with the Irish. So we see there isn't much greater loyalty to the country, is there, that you've got like these different groups. I mean, now we have the United Kingdom, but back then you had these groups that were changing their loyalties at all times and plundering the nation rather than seeing it as all something that belonged to them, to themselves. Any thoughts on this, Treefids?
Yeah, you can see when the king's weak that the lords would try and use that to go raid the country to force his hand, and he would sue for peace so they could gain greater territory. And unfortunately, the peasants would always suffer with this, right? When their villages and towns get raided, obviously it would be really hard for them. But that was how it was back then, right?
Yeah, difficult for everyone, and all these like different factions that had their loyalties to the different lords, and they're all sort of squabbling amongst one another for influence and power as well, aren't they? I guess what we have today is we have these different minority groups and their representatives that are sort of vying for influence and power. And back then you had these different lords. It's a similar thing, really, when you think about it. HR, any thoughts on this?
So, Harold, what was his general background then? I mean, how did he raise to such a claim?
Well, he was the son of Godwin, and Godwin obviously had all these honours. Even though he was a dishonourable man, he was part of the aristocracy. So when he died, his son Harold was raised up to the position that Godwin had before. And then this Algar, he was given the position that Harold had before. And then Algar started causing problems from what I can make out here.
But do you think he was sort of worthy of filling the shoes? Godwin.
Well, he certainly seemed to be a lot better than Godwin. Godwin was responsible for helping to kill the one of those princes, I think, last time, wasn't he? He was working with Harold. There's so many different Harolds that turn up in this, and you got Harold Harefoot that was there before. Before Edward, and then before that there was another Harold, and Harder Canute, sorry, was the one there before Edward. See, I'm getting confused with these Harolds, and now you've got Harold Godwin, who was a good man, or well, he seems to be rather good so far. Well, obviously the Welsh have now made their way into this. The Welsh made several efforts against the Anglo-Saxons in this reign. If any other feeling than personal ambition had actuated the British leaders, they must have discerned that however feeble the Saxon king's government from the new political parties may have been, yet from the comparative state of the two nations, transient depredations were the utmost that the valour of Wales could achieve. Such hounded triumphs were, however, certain of being followed at last by a powerful revenge. Griffith, for some years, molested, with good fortune, the counties near Wales, and for some years his aggressions escaped unchastised. In the year after he first reinstated Algar, his new insults, which occasioned the death of Harold's priest, just raised to a bishopric, were again connived at by a peace, and in 1058 he again restored Algar. But in 1063, Harold resolved to repress him, and there was nothing to restrain the full exercise of his ability. He marched into Wales with adequate force, and Griffith fled. Harold burned his palace and his ships and returned. In the beginning of summer, he circumnavigated Wales with a marauding fleet, while his brother Tostig marched over it by land, and the Welsh submitted with hostages and tribute and banished the obnoxious Griffith, who soon after perished. So they essentially got rid of the King of Wales there. So you can see they're having these problems between the Welsh and the Saxons. The means by which Harold obtained such immediate and decisive success are stated to have been a change of the armour of his soldiers. In heavy armour, the Saxons were unable to pursue the Welsh to their recesses. Harold observed this impediment to their success and commanded them to use leather armour and lighter weapons. By this arrangement, wherever the Britons could retreat, his men could pursue. He crossed their snowy mountains, defeated them on their plains, and spread destruction around, until terror and feebleness produced general subjection. He raised heaps of stones wherever he had obtained victory, with this inscription, "Here Harold conquered." Such a depopulation of Wales ensued from his invasion that to this disastrous cause, Giraldus, that's the historian, ascribes the tranquil acquiescence of the Britons under the Norman yoke. Harold closed his efforts by a law that every Briton found beyond Offa's Dyke with a missile weapon should lose his right hand. So you certainly see the Saxons are in the ascendant here. Any thoughts on this, Truthfids?
Yeah, that's pretty brutal, right? That Harold chopped off all the hands of any men he could find with weapons. And I remember reading Sharon Turner, he put this down to such a, as you said, massive depopulation. A lot of the Welsh fled to Brittany, you know, the top left of France, because of this. But this shows you, if you keep raiding a greater country, you know the king will tolerate it a bit. But if you keep pushing and pushing, eventually he's going to come for you, and you know there's going to be very harsh consequences. So Griffith, he really did a bad service for his people here, right?
Yeah, he pushed things too far, didn't he? I mean, his alliance with these Irish pirates, it wasn't great enough to take on the might of the United Saxons, was it? Patriot, any thoughts on this?
Yes, yeah, it's pretty brutal, to be honest. But like Truffid said, you can only go so far, and, you know, you don't really bite the hand that kind of feeds and supports, you know, the rest of the nation. So it's quite a brutal punishment, but I guess it's, you know, something like that is done to send a direct message, isn't it? A very visible sign to keep them alive, but also take away their livelihoods. And I guess things like that were often done to kind of instate some fear into people and anyone else that might otherwise think it's okay and they could get away with it.
Yeah, and you had to stop people from raiding. So anybody that was found with a weapon, that was it. I mean, it was a pretty strict law. But I find it interesting the way they've changed the technology as well with the armor of the soldiers. I mean, originally they had like very heavy armor, I guess, to protect them from arrows or spears and what have you. But it had just got too heavy and they couldn't chase after the enemy. So they changed that for leather armor so that, that they can pursue them. And because of that, they were able to chase after them around the mountains. I mean, it's even on their own turf. They've been defeated as well. Even on their own home ground, the Welsh were defeated. Macbeth comes into the scene now from made famous by Shakespeare. Macbeth, the usurper of Scotland, condemned by the genius of Shakespeare to share forever our sympathy and our abhorrence, was partly contemporary with Edward. In 1039, Duncan, after a five-year reign, was assassinated by Macbeth. The two sons of Duncan, Malcolm, surnamed Keenmore, or the Great-Headed, and Donald, called Bane, or the Fair, fled from Scotland. Malcolm sought refuge in Cumberland and Donald in the Hebrides. 11 years after his usurpation, Macbeth is mentioned by the chroniclers of England as distributing money at Rome. In 1054, while Macduff, the Thane of Fife, was exciting a formidable revolt in Scotland, the celebrated Siward, by some called the Giant, from his large size, and whose sister had been Duncan's queen, conducted his Northumbrians against Macbeth. A furious conflict followed, in which thousands of both armies perished. But Siward, though he lost his son and nephew, defeated the usurper, and he returned with great plunder, having made Malcolm king. The glory of a warrior was the renown most precious to Siward. On his return at York, he felt that internal disease was consuming his vital principle, and he sighed for the funereal trophies of a field of battle. I feel disgraced that I should have survived so many combats to perish now like a cow. Clothe me in my mail, fasten on my sword, and give me my shield and my battle axe, that I may expire like a soldier. Again, this is interesting. I mean, this shows the honour that people used to have. They would rather die than actually accept slavery. When you went into battle in the ancient world, and if you lost, you were given a choice. You can either fall on your sword, or you can suffer being a slave. And a lot of people would rather die than actually be a slave. And you see here that he wanted to die as if he died fighting, rather than if he had been taken down by some illness, as if he was no more than a lowly beast. I mean, what do you make of this? Do you know much about Macbeth, Truefitz?
Yeah, just a little bit from reading, you know, Shakespeare back in the day. What I find interesting is that if Shakespeare was always writing generally on historical figures, then it also adds light to King Lear, right, who was said to be one of the ancient Briton kings. I can't remember, was it 200 BC or 300, you know, so it was quite old. But clearly Shakespeare must have believed that he actually lived if he's writing about all these other historical figures, right? He wouldn't just randomly make up a guy.
Yeah, King Lear is mentioned in the early Welsh histories. There have been people over the years that claim to have found coinage with King Lear on them. I think maybe he was just at the time, just before we actually had coinage, but I think he did exist. He certainly existed for Shakespeare because he was honoured with this play just the same as Macbeth was. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, he was. Well, Shakespeare obviously was quite influential, and you know, people. I think with someone like Shakespeare, he probably over dramatized a lot of the sort of warlike and heroicism and things, and maybe that started to condition the people a bit more as well. You know, to influence them and almost want to be remembered and have stories told about them as well, you know. And I think prior to Shakespeare, they probably didn't have someone as with such renown and kind of storytelling. Well, they did, but I think Shakespeare obviously was cut in the mold and made storytelling and playwriting, and they probably had a lot more of the arts going off. And I just think sort of becoming a character maybe just had some influence on soldiers and that at the time.
Yeah, there was a huge increase in arts at the time of Shakespeare. I mean, he wasn't contemporary with Macbeth. It was later on, I think, in the time of Elizabeth I. But I think when he wrote his plays, he was talking about things that were common knowledge about our history. You know, we all understood what our history was back then and where we came from. And King Lear was from the line of Brutus, and that was accepted as the history of the country. I mean, the Brut, which is the Chronicle of England, it was second only to the Bible itself in the number of copies that it had. And there's a book called The Faerie Queen by Spencer, various other works that were based upon the Brut. And the history of the kings of England is also based upon the Brut. And that expands upon it, gives it a little more of a literary descriptive flavour. And when Geoffrey of Monmouth was writing that, he said, all of this comes from original texts. This comes from an original book. I'm not making this up. And of course, today people say, oh, well, it was all legendary. It's all mythical. But it wouldn't have been. I mean, the bards would have remembered these stories, and they would have passed them down orally. They would have had rhymes to them to help them to remember them. And Shakespeare was writing about that. And I guess Macbeth was quite close, a lot more closer to the time of Shakespeare than Lear, King Lear, was. But they must have all existed. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been making these plays about them. In 1057, England lost Leofric, the Duke of Mercia, by whose wisdom the reign of Edward was preserved from many perils and disorders, which the ambition of others would have introduced. His counsels and government have been much celebrated. His son Algar succeeded to his dukedom. On Siward's death in 1055, Tostig, the brother of Harold, was appointed Earl of Northumbria. By inducing the queen to cause some Northumbrian nobles to be treacherously killed, by repeating the same atrocity himself at York, and by exacting a large tribute from the country, Tostig so alienated the minds of the provincials that they revolted in 1065, expelled him, and seized his treasures. The insurgents invited Mortar, the son of Algar, and chose him for their earl. At the head of the men of Northumberland, Morcar marched southwards and was joined by an armed force from other counties and from Wates. Harold met him at Northampton with military array, but it was deemed prudent to comply with a request so powerfully supported, and Mortar was confirmed in the earldom and the laws of Canute were restored. Tostig fled with his wife and friends to Flanders, where Baldwin entertainment. I think we're seeing much loyalty here between these elves, between the aristocracy and the people that they're ruling over. And they're supposed to have this noblesse oblige, where they're obliged to be charitable to the people that they're ruling over. And the general idea is that you have to have poor people, because otherwise there wouldn't be a chance to exercise charity amongst the aristocracy, and the wealth that was supposed to be given to the poor would then circulate, basically within the country, and it would help, everybody out, and it would travel from the poor to the nobles and back to the poor again. But it seems here as if these nobles that have been put in charge of the people, a lot of them were really not very nice people, and they alienated the people that they were ruling over. Any thoughts about this, Truefids?
Yeah, so here you see how powerful Harold is, right? He's basically going out and constantly putting down these rebellions, but he's not actually the king, it's actually Edward. But you can see later how obviously people are going to pick Harold to be the next king, because who else would they pick? And and here also Tostix, his brother, so he's basically banished or fled, and that will come back to haunt Harold later, because when Harold becomes king, he won't let Tostig come back and regain his land, if I recall. So Tostig ends up going to the other Harold in Norway and inviting him to invade. And when Harold met him in battle, he beat him, but he was greatly weakened because of that battle. And that's when William the Conqueror came in. So there's lots of events going on, but I just thought I'd note that, so that people realize later on all these pieces fit in together, right?
It's interesting how a lot of the time you got brothers with two different characters. You got like recently in the last episode we heard about how one of these brothers murdered his half brother, or he had his eyes put out. He had him sneakily brought back from Norway, pretending that it was his wife or his half brother's, or his mother rather, that was inviting this son back. And then he had his eyes poked out. And then you have this other brother that comes in, Harefoot Canute, I think his name was, or Harder Canute. And he comes in, and then he digs up the body of the Harold that murdered this other prince, and he has him decapitated and thrown into the bog. And he was very, very upset at the fact that he killed his half brother. So you got completely different characters amongst these brothers here, and I think we can see that here again with Tostig. You've got this noble, brave Harold who goes out and puts down all these rebellions, and he's liked by the people. I don't know if he was loved, but he was certainly liked by the people. And then you've got his brother Tostig, who introduces this plot to kill the nobles, treacherously kills the nobles. He's a bad influence on his wife, and he totally alienates all the people that he's ruling over so much that they revolt and expel him and seize his treasures. I mean, he must have been a really nasty piece of work. You can contrast that to Harold. I just find it interesting that there's such a difference between the characters of these brothers, and yet they're sired by the same father. It's interesting. And I guess maybe that in the next generation there would be, or his son would be good as well, because we see that with Godwin's son, or Godwin. We see that Godwin was a horrible person, but then we see that his son was a decent person. So I guess they all have the potential to be decent, but some of them turn out to be wicked. Any thoughts on this, Patriarch?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting how siblings can be so different. But I think we come to understand now that a lot of the personality traits are kind of predefined in the genome, and it can spring up from your ancestors going back generations. So a lot of whilst people's character can be shaped, a lot of personality traits are predestined almost, and a lot of the time it doesn't have too much to do with the parents and how they've been brought up. Just it's purely natural.
Yeah, I think that also plays into this idea of having the king as well, that it's hereditary. So you've got a family there, and the chances are that the son, or the eldest son, is going to be decent. He might not be decent, but he might be. So every so often you would get a bad king, but most of the time you would get a good king, and then every so often you would get a great king. But at least they had a king. Having a bad king, you could always say, well, at least it's likely to be a good king because he was descended from the last great king. as it were, rather than just picking somebody at random. You had a family line there that you knew did have very decent people in it. So you could be guaranteed that even if you had a bad king this generation, the next generation, you would be very likely to have a good king. Well, Edward unfortunately dies around about this time. Edward, whose passive and peaceful disposition seems to have left his nobles to their own quarrels without any interposition from himself, soon after these transactions began to sicken. At Christmas, he held his court in London and dedicated the Church of St. Peter at Westminster, which he had rebuilt. On the eve of the Epiphany, his malady assumed a fatal aspect, and he was buried the day following at Westminster. In person, Edward was tall and well-made. His hair and skin were remarkably white, his complexion rosy. His mind was gentle, if not weak, but in general, unless acted upon by others, his disposition was well-meaning. He was averse to the imposition of taxes, abstinent in his diet, and on the public feast days, though by the care of the Queen he was sumptuously arrayed, he assumed no haughtiness of manner in his pomp. His piety was sincere and fervent, and his time was chiefly divided between his prayers and hunting, to which he was greatly attached. His charities were frequent and extensive, and though his reign displayed no intellectual energies and reflected no honour on his ancestry, he was so fortunate as to escape any striking disgrace. Well, I would disagree there, where it says it reflected no honour on his ancestry. I think the fact that he did away with the Danegeld, that brought great honour to him. And as it says here, his charities were frequent and extensive, and he was against taxing the people. He was against the imposition of taxes. I think that brings great honour to his ancestry, and would have foretold that his issue would have been similar, or at least in one generation they would have had somebody else that cared about the people that they were ruling over as well. Any thoughts on this, True Fitz?
I guess he means he wasn't very energetic. All the other previous kings were constantly looking to expand, you know, and build an empire, whilst Edward seems to be very humble and just content with what he has, and dedicated somewhat to his people, right? And praying and hunting, they seem to be what he really likes. But yeah, it's interesting that later Edward I would get named after this. Sorry. It's interesting that later Edward I would get named after this Edward. So he must have been looked up to, you know, a century or two centuries after for his, you know, gentle-heartedness and his good character.
Yeah, Edward I's father named him because of Edward the Confessor. He was a big fan of Edward the Confessor. So I'm surprised we haven't read anything about him being a saint. I think he was actually sainted, this Edward. I also find it interesting, it talks about the complexion here. It says that his skin was remarkably white and his complexion was rosy. I mean, here in the Old Testament, that King David, his complexion was rosy. So this tells us the specific ethnicity that the king was. Any thoughts on this, Patriarch?
Yeah, I mean, he'd have thought that it would have been something to be really remembered by, as someone to have, you know, got rid of the Danegeld. But like Triffid said as well, if he wasn't expanding, I guess people, outsiders, would have perceived that as weakness. And at that time where, you know, everything wasn't unified, I guess as much as he kind of loved the people and wanted to kind of just be content with what is, you know, maybe it just wasn't the time to be so complacent with what you've got, because there's, you know, a lot of dangers around the corner and people kind of plotting in wake, ready to take what you've got.
Well, it was people like Harold that protected him, wasn't he, and protected his realm. And it was Harold that was gaining the honour in these battles and putting down the Welsh and the Irish when they were making these raids. So he did have his generals, I guess you could say, that were carrying out these battles. Next, we come to the reign of Harold II, the son of Godwin, who is the last of the Anglo-Saxon kings. Edward had intended to appoint his cousin Edward, the son of Edmund Ironside, as the successor to his crown. The prince had continued in Hungary since Canute had sought his life. Called from thence by Edward the Confessor, he came to England in 1057, but he died soon after his arrival. So you sort of wonder what he would have been like. I mean, Edmund Ironside was a fantastic king as well, fighting against Canute, but even his issue died as soon as he got to the country. The death of this prince confirmed in two men the hopes of attaining the Anglo-Saxon sceptre, Harold and William, the Duke of Normandy. After this event, both looked forward to the splendid prize with equal ardour. Harold had sworn to William to assist him in ascending the throne of England, but afterwards pleaded that his oaths had been extorted by irresistible force, as William, having had him in his power, compelled him to swear. This charge, thus repelled, the rivals were in other respects on a level. Both claimed from Edward a gift or testamentary appointment in his favour. Both had been in Edward's friendship, and the family of Harold, as well as the family of William, had been connubially allied to him. There is perhaps no great event in our annals in which the truth is more difficult to be elicited than in the transaction between Harold and William in the lifetime of Edward. We will first state the account of Harold and his friends and then contrast it with the Norman story. In revolving the history of the friends of Harold, we meet with the unpleasing circumstances of two narrations upon the subject, which counteract each other. According to some, Harold accidentally sailed in a little fishing excursion from Bosham in Sussex and was driven by a sudden tempest on the opposite shore. According to others, Harold went to the continent not accidentally, but deliberately. Two of his brothers had been committed by Edward during the rebellion of Godwin to the care of William. Harold wished to procure their release, and for that purpose is said to have requested permission of Edward to visit William in Normandy. And the appendage to this account is that Edward dissuaded him in vain, and that when Harold returned and stated to him that William had detained and made him swear to give him the English crown, the king reminded him that he had foreseen the misfortune. The Norman historians declare that on the death of the son of Edmund Ironside, who had been invited from Hungary, Edward obeyed the dictates of personal regard and appointed William to be his successor, that he sent Harold to announce to him this disposition, and that Harold, sailing to Flanders for the purpose of travelling to the Norman court on this important mission, was thrown by a tempest on the coast of the Count of Pontio, who seized and imprisoned him. To these circumstances, it is added that before Edward sent Harold, he had commissioned Robert the Norman, the Archbishop of Canterbury, to make to William the same annunciation. This last assertion, however, cannot for a moment be believed, because Robert was exiled from England in the year 1052 on Godwin's reconciliation. He went to Normandy not on public business, but fled with precipitation to secure his personal safety. And so far was Edward from having adopted William in 1052 that in 1057 the son of Edmund Ironside came to England on Edward's express invitation and for the avowed purpose of being his successor. It is also hostile to the tale of Robert's mission that William was himself in England after Godwin's rebellion the year before Robert left it. If Edward had then determined on William's succession, it is more probable that he should have imparted his intention to William himself than that in the next year he should have sent it in a message by a fugitive. The testimony of Ingulf of Croyland is also adverse. He expressly declares that while William was in England, he received no hopes of the succession. It was not then mentioned. Robert may have exerted himself in nurturing William's secret wishes. He may, in revenge to the family of Godwin, have commenced intrigues in favour of William, but it is not credible that Edward thought of William as his successor until after the death of his cousin from Hungary. So this is interesting here. Obviously, Edward wanted his cousin to actually be king, but he died before he got there. So then the second choice comes in, and I'm not quite sure whether Edward was still alive when his cousin died. What do you make of this truth, Vids? What do you think is the truth?
Yeah, I think his cousin did die. I think Harold's version is much more plausible. because Harold had been basically running England, not necessarily running it, but he's leading the armies all across England, putting down all these rebellions. So I very much doubt Harold being that powerful, Edward would just tell him, oh, by the way, go tell William over there that he's going to be the king. Harold would never agree to that because, you know, his father was also constantly rebelling against the king. I think it's much more likely. We do know that one of his brothers had been banished to Flanders. That would be Holland. So if they somehow ended up in the care of William, perhaps William realized, you know, William's plotting and he's got the two brothers over trying to bait Harold to come over. And then if you read, Sharon Turner explains how Harold was captured by another guy and William came over, released him, but then he forced him to swear to make Harold the king, to support him. And then there was something where once Harold had sworn, he uncloaked a blanket or something and underneath were all holy relics. And you know, in that those times, they believed if you made an oath over a holy relic, it was even more of an oath, you know, because an oath should just be an oath, right? But then Harold was greatly displeased to have seen that. But he, as Sharon Turner said later, he said, well, look, you forced me to swear this under the pretense that you would put me to death. So it's not really an oath, is it? Because, you know, you forced me. I think that makes a lot more sense than Harold going over and telling William, you're going to be the heir. That's my opinion anyways.
So it was an oath under duress. But I mean, didn't William actually have a claim to the throne through royalty and through his ancestry? Did Godwin also have a claim to the throne then? Because Godwin was a noble and Harold is Godwin's son. But did he actually have a claim to the throne, do you know? Because William did have a claim to the throne, even though he was illegitimate.
William's wife was descended from Alfred the Great. That would be about the only claim.
Right, so that would be the link there. So it's his wife that has the link to Alfred the Great, and William is the son of somebody who is royal, but he was illegitimate. He wasn't actually produced by the queen. So which of those has the greater claim? So it does seem to me as if it was up for grabs, basically. It was down to who had the most strength. I mean, what do you make of this patriarch? Who do you think should have been made king?
It's hard to say. I mean, because, well, there's different sort of jurisdictions as well. I mean, who is the ultimate the ultimate ancestry line? Is it through Alfred or through other kings of Wales and or Anglo-Saxons? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of the different lineages are trying to make a claim, but who would you say is the rightful sort of line through? I mean, I know it was mentioned that the only claim through William was through his Alfred through his aunt or mother?
Through his mother. Well, I think, well, obviously through his father, but his mother wasn't acknowledged as a queen. So he was also known as William the Bastard, as well as William the Conqueror and William the Norman. But I think there's another. Well, go on.
I was just going to say. So I mean, objectively, who would be the rightful heir then?
Well, this is just it, isn't it? And also, even though these two nobles will be arguing over it, and they could fight over it, and then it also depends on who the church recognizes as the king. Because don't forget, we had this Harold, the son of Canute. He was made king, but the church refused to recognize him as king. So that was why he killed this other Anglo-Saxon prince that he got back under false pretenses, because the archbishop wouldn't recognize him as king. So it wasn't just that you would have a fight over it, but also then you had to contend with which one the church was going to recognize. And the church would have not wanted to recognize somebody who was the illegitimate son, because they had a big thing about illegitimacy, didn't they? Particularly the British church, maybe not so much with the church in churches in Scandinavia, because they seemed to tolerate extra wives, didn't they? But Augustine certainly didn't like this idea of having extra wives. He complained about that with the Welsh Church. Well, the main thing that is to do with this time that we've all heard about is the Bayeux Tapestry. The celebrated tapestry of Bayeux presents to us the Norman account of these transactions. In the Cathedral Church of Bayeux in Normandy, this ancient monument has been preserved. The ground of this piece of work is a white linen cloth or canvas, 1 foot 11 inches in depth and 212 feet in length. The figures of men, horses and others are in their proper colours, worked in the manner of samplers, is worked and of a style not unlike what we see upon China and Japan ware, those of the men more particularly being without the least symmetry or proportion. It is in one piece, and it was annually hung up and exposed to view in the nave of the church from the eve of Midsummer Day and continued there for 8 days. At all other times, it was carefully locked up. This tapestry is called by the tradition of the country La Toilette de Duc Willem. The same popular account ascribes it to his queen Matilda and her workwomen. It has been engraved and it may be seen among the plates of the Academy des Inscriptions and in Ducarel's Anglo-Norman Antiquities. I can remember learning about this when I was a child, the tapestry of Bayeux. I think it's something they still include in history today. Quite incredible when you think about it. You know, how are they going to retell this history? Well, we'll make an animation up and we'll put it all on a tapestry. You're interested in all animation and art, Patriot. I'll ask you about this one first. What do you make of the Bayeux tapestry? Do you know much about it?
I don't know too much about it, but from the images, it's almost like an Anglo-Saxon version of sort of Egyptian scribing, you know, scribes and hieroglyphics, kind of similar to that, but obviously in more sequential form. I mean, they do look quite nice, and yeah, it's sort of got the hints of the sort of an Asiatic style as well. But yeah, it's just very Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah, it's like, it reminds me of sort of an animation, you know, or a cartoon, but from a thousand years ago, and made out of cloth and weaving and stitching into the cloth. I guess it was something that we used to do back then. Truthfeeds, do you know much about the Bayeux tapestry?
No, I don't, but I've actually looked at the pictures and, you know, it's quite interesting. You do see that they were trying to recreate, you know, from the Normans' perspective, this great moment when the Normans came to rule. So obviously they want to make out that it's this grandeur event and it's all destiny, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, and that also reminds me, because this was displayed within a church, wasn't it? And it was also the Pope that backed William the Conqueror. It was the Pope that actually backed William. So he knew that if he could win this battle, then the church would acknowledge him. And also at this period, because this is 1066, we had recently, I think it was 1056 or 1060, there was the schism in the church. And the church split, and what had originally been the Catholic Church then became the Roman Catholic Church on the west, and on the east it became the Eastern Orthodox Church. And I think Britain had always had a lot to do with Constantinople and had looked to Constantinople to solve canonical law, right, as that was the court of last appeal to, rather than the court at Rome. So it may have been this that Rome had said to William, you need to take over in England. Because I think when William did take over, he replaced all the bishops with Norman bishops, obviously bishops that would have been loyal to the Pope, because we had this schism that took place. So the church split and we then end up with the Roman Catholic Church and Eastern Orthodox. So I've always thought that that may have played a role in this as well, because that happened literally either in 1056 or 1060. So just within 10 years, this huge schism between the church. So it may have been that the Pope wanted to ensure that England remained with the Roman Catholics rather than going with the Eastern Orthodox. Any thoughts on that, Truefitz?
Yeah, and if you remember earlier, was it last episode or the episode before, Edward had put the Norman bishop as one of the archbishops, I believe. And then I think he got banished, the Harold, or it might be Godwin, managed to get him, got rid of him, and then that bishop went to the Pope and petitioned that, you know, William should be the new king later on. So it all, again, all these events. So you see that obviously he wanted back in England, and the only way he could do that was with William's help. So they were kind of helping each other, right? William would get the backing, and as a result, he would reward all those bishops.
So you've even got factions in the church as well as in the aristocracy. Any thoughts about this great schism in the church at this time, Patriarch?
Well, it probably was something that it seemed like there was a lot of disagreements in general, and obviously the right heir to the throne was sort of in disarray, and I guess, you know, the schism within the church was kind of following suits as well, because obviously if the people are kind of torn, then that would probably send sort of shockwaves through all the other institutions as well, and, you know, forming lots of different alliances here and there. I think something like that was probably inevitable.
Yeah, and then later on you had the Protestant Revolution as well, which was, I think, 4 or 5 centuries later. And I think the source of the discontent was with the control that the Pope had by this time, whereas originally the Bishop of Rome was first among equals, and by this time he was starting to have a lot of power. And I think that that may have caused some issues with the Eastern Orthodox. So we split there, and then we have the Roman Catholic Church, and then we also have the Eastern Orthodox. Well, the tapestry represents the transactions between Harold and William. The first figures are a king with a sceptre sitting upon his throne, and his right hand is pointed towards two men as if giving them orders. Above is an inscription of two words, Edward Rex, which means King Edward. This has been fairly thought to portray Edward directing Harold to go to Normandy. It therefore illustrates the Norman account that Harold was sent by Edward to William. The next figures are 5 men on horseback, preceded by a cavalier with a bird in his left hand and with 5 dogs running before him. The inscription to this is A Harold Dux Anglorum et sui milite equitant ad bosom. The dogs and the bird mark the cavalier to be a nobleman, and of course to be Harold, who is proceeding with his train to Bosham. So it's interesting they actually have words here to accompany this. It's not like you're just having to work out what's going on from the pictures. A church follows, before which are 2 men with bending knees. Above is the word Ecclesia, which obviously marks them out as being churchmen. After this is an apartment where men are drinking, one from a horn and another from a goblet. 2 men are descending from this place of refreshment, one of them with an oar. A person with an oar is standing next. Another holds a dog in his arm, looking towards a ship, close to which is Harold, with a dog under his arm and a bird in his left hand. And the inscription is Hic Harold mare navigavit. It, of course, represents Harold embarking at Bosham in Sussex. 2 ships follow in full sail. The remark of Lancelot is just that in their equipment they are not at all like fishing vessels, and the words are et vales vento plenis venit in terra vidonis comitis. The next figures represent Harold becoming the prisoner of Guy, the Count of Pontio, who carries him to Belair and detains him. The inscriptions will explain the figures which follow. Here Harold and Guy converse. Here the messengers of William came to Guy. Here a messenger comes to William. Here Guy conducted Harold to William, Duke of the Normans. And here William proceeds with Harold to his palace. So it's like this is put up there basically as this must have happened. This is the way that it happened because we have commemorated it all here. So I think the fact that they actually have this says that there was a big argument over this at the time. This part of the tapestry portrays the history as given in the Chronicles, when Harold was detained by Guy, on whose coasts the winds impelled him. This information was given to William, whose menaces and gifts produced his release. And I'll just pause there. Do you want to make any comments on this up to this point here, Truthvids?
Yeah, it's basically, I think it's kind of propaganda, but then sometimes they say the truth is somewhere in between, right? So, we'll never know. But you know, Harold must have met William then, and you know, it's interesting to see that they did know each other, and they must have had lots of conversations, and then later they have a battle, so they did know each other quite well then.
Yeah, and Edward obviously got on very well with the Normans. He favoured the Normans above the Saxons at one point. Patriarch, do you want to add any comments here?
So the reason for this, the tapestry then, obviously kind of really wanted, it was clearly an iconic moment, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very important to the Normans that they commemorate this. And because if you think about it before, you've got the British kings and they've got part of France, haven't they? They've got Brittany and that's part of the British realm. And now you've got the Norman kings from Normandy and they've taken over Britain. So things have reversed. That William conducted Harold to Rouse, the chief city of his dominions, is the assertion of a contemporary chronicler. The tapestry says to his palace and exhibits a kind of hall where a chief upon his throne, resting one hand on his sword, is attending to a person in the attitude of speaking, behind whom are some armed men. It is most likely Harold addressing William on the subject of his excursion, but there is no inscription on this part of the tapestry. The next figures represent William's warfare with Conan, a count of Brittany, in which Harold assisted. The inscriptions are, here Duke William and his army came to Mount St. Michael and passed the river Cosno. Here Harold Duke drew from them the sand, and they came to Dol, and Conan fled. Here the soldiers of Duke William fought against the Danans, and Conan extended the keys. All these circumstances are very expressively told by appropriate figures, which gives a curious delineation of the military equipments and the manners of the period. And it's interesting that it talks about these places, Dol. That was Samson of Dol, was a famous Celtic saint. You've got Mount St. Michael here, which was also another famous place to do with the church. And Mont St. Michael is obviously still there, and this Conan we've heard about before as well. I mean, it's going into a lot of in-depth history here. It's not just glossing over what was happening, and it's probably going to take us a while to actually get through the rest of this tapestry. And I know you two guys have got things that we need to get going with, so I think we'll probably pause it here. Do you want to give any final thoughts on this or what was happening here, Truefids, before we finish?
Yeah, you see that even during this, William is putting down rebellions, and he basically lived his whole life through warfare, constant strife. We see Harold also was, raised to be a warrior. He's fighting rebellions in England. So, but both were, you know, serious military commanders. And of course, hopefully we'll get to the battle eventually, and we'll see. Well, we know what happens, but it's just interesting seeing all this life experience that they had, and that both would have been capable kings, right?
Yeah, and everything building up to the great battle at the end in this tapestry. Patriarch, any final thoughts on today before we finish?
Yeah, well, I'd love to, for one, know if we're still possible to see this tapestry and where it is. But I think this distinct type of artwork is obviously kind of what it kind of goes to show the extent to which they want their history to be remembered. There was obviously a climatic era and a big turn of events, and there was obviously, you know, really wanted to cement their legacy from their perspective.
You wonder how often they've made these sort of tapestries as well, because of the nature of the fact that they're made from cloth, they're not really going to survive the test of time. And yet this one has. It sort of reminds me of the cloth equivalent of a mosaic, perhaps. Well, let's leave that here for now then. Thank you very much for coming on today, Truefids.
Thanks for having me, as always, Sven.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Do remember to check out earlier episodes of Patriotic History in our archive. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.